Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast, a podcast where we talk about baseball. And baseball is a sport where spring training starts in the winter, the boys of summer start in the spring, and the winter meetings are in the fall. So here we go. The winter meetings are on. And we're going to talk about what is happening and what is not happening. With me to talk about it is MLBTR founder Tim Durkis. How's it going, Tim?
Good, good. Happy to be here, Dara.
So winter meetings, like I said, some stuff's happening, some stuff's not happening. We want to start with Shohei Ohtani. What are your thoughts on what is or is not happening with Shohei Ohtani, Tim?
I mean, I think there's a few points of mild interest there. Medium interest, maybe. The Ken Rosenthal report of Shohei being in Dunedin on Monday, that's good. That's a good development and exciting. And I think our team kind of talked about this offline, but what do you think of the whole shrouded in secrecy thing?
I was thinking about this last night, and what I came up with was this. Do you know the Van Halen Brown M&Ms thing?
I do not.
So there was this story, like a rock and roll legend for a long time about how, you know, in their rider, the thing where you give the specifications for what's backstage and stuff like that, they needed to have a bowl of M&Ms with the brown ones removed.
Okay, and I might have heard that, yeah.
And this was given as an example of like crazy demanding rock stars. They need to have all this champagne and caviar and, oh, the brown M&Ms have to be removed from the thing. But then somebody from Van Halen later explained that what this was a test. When they were showing up to a new venue, they had like complicated like lighting rigs and stuff like that and fireworks and whatever. I don't know. But if they showed up to a venue and they saw the M&Ms with the brown ones removed, then they knew that the rider had been read thoroughly. Whereas if they did not see that, then they were worried and they were like, we have to check everything. And I was thinking that with Shohei Ohtani, I think it's just about ensuring a level of participation with this shrouded in secrecy stuff, where it's just because they have more leverage than every other free agent. Every other free agent, the team has some ability to be like, if the demands are ridiculous, then it's like, okay, we'll go talk to somebody else. There are other outfielders. There are other catchers. There's other third basemen. Shohei Ohtani, there's no other Shohei Ohtani. And so they're just like, these are the rules. You play by the rules or you're not at the table. And I don't know how serious that is, but that seems to be the rules that they're setting out.
Yeah. And I think that Shohei and his agent, Nez Bolelo, I think that they know that the extreme secrecy rules are not enforceable unless they kind of feed some fake information to one team to see if it goes in the media. Like, they can't actually test that. And I don't think that there's a feeling. I would assume there's not a feeling from his camp that the Blue Jays front office leaked that spring training facility visit. And in fact, it seems like they did everything in their power to not talk about where Ross Atkins was yesterday. And be almost weirdly cagey with reporters about it and, you know, on the Zoom call and stuff. So it's not enforceable, but it's kind of Shohei, you know, in his time here, especially once he's become a superstar, has been all about kind of controlling the process. So, I mean, it's not a big surprise that he would want to run his free agency the same way. I guess one question I would have to pose here would be, if you're this generational superstar, you know, you're the Babe Ruth of the modern era, do you have some sort of obligation to be more of an ambassador and to, I can see why he might not want to embrace the circus or pageantry of free agency. A lot of players don't. But, you know, he's also a guy who didn't talk to the media after he won the MVP award. And hasn't talked to the media for months and didn't do a press conference about his surgery. And I mean, I think some would argue that if you're this popular, this good, that you do have an obligation to do certain things for the game of baseball. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's an interesting conversation, and I can only have so much insight into it because I'm not one of these people. I remember this came up. I'm not a huge tennis person, but there was some tennis player who like didn't want to do post-match press conferences, and they talked about how like they had anxiety or whatever, and they didn't enjoy the process and they didn't want to do it. And then other tennis players were talking about how like there was an obligation, like you said, to for the good of the sport to take part in that PR process, even if you didn't enjoy it, because your employment was incumbent on this media machine to make you a star and make you your money kind of thing. And so I see what you're saying, but at the same time, I think, you know, even without Ohtani doing a lot of press stuff, he's still a big star. He's still in all the highlight packages and all that kind of stuff. So it's not like this secrecy is like, do you think that the level of secrecy that he is operating on is like negatively impacting the sport right now in like the terms of like the rumors and the offseason hype machine?
I do not think it has a negative impact, but I think that MLB has shown that they do care a lot about the hot stove. They realize that there's a lot of value in having people talking about the game in November and December and January and getting excited about free agency. And I know MLB.com has dedicated people on hot stove stuff and sections of their website. So they definitely care. And so I think that they would see, you know, what should or could be the biggest free agency of all of our lifetimes as a potential opportunity. But since Shohei is one man and he can call these shots and so can his agent, it's just, you know, if he had a different personality, this thing could be a bonanza. And also, I think that there is a middle ground between like nothing can come out versus like Trevor Bauer level of I'm making hype videos along the way talking about stuff. And so like even with Shohei, when he came over here, he did the thing with seven finalists. You know, they did the statement. I think that was an agent statement where they announced the seven finalists. And I'm not sure what his intent was in doing that, but I think that that was pretty fun for the hot stove element or for the just for the fans. And so I guess I don't really see the harm in his market. It, you know, the rumor is that he's down to, let's say, five teams. That's enough teams to get him his maximum price. And I don't think he needs to pretend that there's a sixth, seventh, and eighth team to be able to get whatever amount of money he wants. So if he really is down to five, you know, if he did a little friendly interview on his own YouTube channel, hey, these are the five teams I'm looking at. I can't wait to make my decision. And I know he's not into that type of hype, but I don't think it would be a huge ask of him to do something like that. And you could imagine how things would go kind of nuts if he narrowed his teams down and those fan bases kind of all felt like they were in it. And it would be also good for his market. So I would say he's not causing harm as much as it's just a missed opportunity. You know, people used to talk about, you know, his teammate, Mike Trout, didn't maybe have the biggest personality or doesn't have kind of like this Fernando Tatis level like charisma. And so Ohtani, I think, does have charisma. He just chooses to kind of only show it on the field. So it just feels like a bit of a missed opportunity. I could see him, you know, one thing I was thinking of, you know, mentioned Van Halen. I was thinking of Taylor Swift. And I had read recently that Taylor hasn't done kind of a traditional interview where, you know, not all the questions are approved and there could be something interesting said. She hasn't done that for several years or 5 years or something like that. And the reason, of course, is that she doesn't have to. And so I think that ultimately Shohei has made the same, come to the same conclusion. You know, what is the benefit to me of doing this? I'm already the most popular player. I don't have, you know, negativity around me. So why go ahead and why like kind of invite those challenges? I was thinking, though, if this is going to be a 12-year contract, if this is indeed a contract that takes him to the end of his career, and it's a contract that pays, say, $50 million a year, something kind of astronomical that a certain amount of fans blanch at, and if you don't have any media in your corner because you haven't talked to them at all because you didn't need them, then I think when he inevitably stops being worth $50 million at some point, age 35, age 36, age 34, we don't really know, fans could turn on him to some degree. And I think that if he had built up some goodwill, you know, they wouldn't. And I think that that's a, you know, a 5 to 7 year from now problem, but it's just something I was thinking about is, you know, man, if he's making $50 million a year and he's, you know, injured a lot, or he stops pitching, or his hitting takes a turn, and then he never talks to anybody, his teammates could start to get mad. The fan bases could get mad about the money being tied up. And you know, that could be, it could be a bit of a bummer of an end, as we often see on a lot of these contracts, like Pujols or whoever. These things don't always end well.
Yeah, the post-signing PR, I think, is going to be a really fascinating part of it, because, you know, we're like right now, Ohtani has the ability to control the narrative and is doing so. But presumably, part of the attraction for the signing team in giving him this massive contract is that they can promote him. They can sell jerseys, they can sell tickets, they can improve TV ratings. So I wonder how much he is going to want to control that. You know, it seems like with the Angels, they let him not talk to the media very much, and he seemed to like that. And some people have said he doesn't want to play in New York because the media demands would be higher. And, you know, I wonder, because I'm in Toronto and, you know, the Jays have been actively involved in this thing. The Blue Jays are owned by the broadcaster, like they're one and the same. And so obviously that would be attractive to them in that, you know, imagine for an American, if you don't know, it's like, I don't know, if Disney owned a baseball team and that team was on ESPN every night, that's what the Blue Jays are. They are owned by Rogers, and there's a channel called Rogers Sportsnet, and they play the Blue Jays every night, except when they're on Apple TV or whatever. And so, you know, sometimes they also do these like in-depth interviews where it's like one of the reporters sits down with Vladdy Guerrero for like half an hour. And it's like sort of like one of those ESPN documentary type things. So like, do the Jays want Ohtani to do that kind of stuff? Does he not want to do that? Do they care? Like, do they think he can just sell tickets even if he doesn't do that kind of stuff? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if those things are actually factors.
Yeah. And I mean, we hear a lot of kind of vague stuff about how much money he's worth beyond his play on the field, but it's always vague. You know, we don't know the value of 10 Ohtani exclusive in-depth interviews per year. We don't know that he would do that. We don't necessarily think that he would do that. So it's kind of an unknown. And I mean, I think I did read something where, you know, they compared attendance when he pitched for the Angels versus, you know, the days surrounding that. And it was like a couple hundred fans additionally came to the stadium. I don't know if that would be the case for other teams, and I don't think it would be the case in year one. I think that he would cause a real boost. And of course, there's kind of the merchandise, and just, you know, there's a lot of things, but I think it's hard to quantify. And I think that if he was embracing his celebrity a bit, that the value of all that would be higher.
Okay, well, we will see what happens there. It seems like this is sort of holding up the market from truly exploding at these winter meetings, but we'll see. We're recording this on Tuesday morning, so we'll see what happens. Stay tuned to MLBTradeRumors.com for all the latest. At some point, Ohtani will sign and the dam will break and it'll go nuts and you'll want to be there. And sign up for the front office package because it's cheap and it gets rid of the ads and you get extra stuff. But let's turn from stuff that's not happening to stuff that is happening. The most significant transaction so far of the winter meetings, I would say, was a trade between the Mariners and Atlanta. Did you have thoughts when this trade came out too?
Yeah, I did. I mean, my first thought is always like, if everybody is saying one thing about it, that I want to give some extra consideration to the other side of that, because I don't know, I guess I'm just maybe a contrarian by nature. But you know, if all kind of analysis is the same, then that doesn't feel nuanced enough to me. So, you know, when we talk about Jared Kelnick trade, there's a lot to think about. I mean, I think the headline here, and there's a good article from Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times that came out recently, but the headline here is that Mariners ownership cut player payroll due to some changes in the TV situation. And Jerry DePoto has different parameters than he did a month or two ago. And so this is not something he's randomly decided to do. I've seen a lot of, you know, grief that's been directed his way on Twitter. And it's like, well, he didn't just decide to kind of effectively sell Jared Kelnick for no reason. I think he analyzed his different mechanisms to shed salary, and he decided to make a bet against Jared Kelnick. I mean, it really comes down to that. If you look at all the money involved and kind of run some numbers, you know, my estimate would be that the Braves have effectively bought Kelnick's, you know, next five seasons for $25 million aside from Kelnick's own salaries. I mean, one thing that would create an interesting thought exercise would be, okay, Jared Kelnick, he's 24. He's granted free agency through some loophole. He's a free agent right now. And you have to sign him to a five-year deal. What's he get? What do you think he gets?
I think we talked about this with Anthony and Steve, and I think there was a comparison to Jung-Hoo Lee, who's coming over from Korea, who's similarly sort of, you know, he's going to be 25. He sort of, like Kelnick, is unproven at the MLB level because he has no major league experience, whereas Kelnick only has, like, I don't know, what, one good month. So, you know, our prediction, what did we have on Lee? Like 50 million, something like that,
yeah,
in the top 50?
Yeah, which was, came with a lot of uncertainty. Yeah.
So does something in that range seem like probably what you would think Kelnick would get?
Yeah, I mean, my thought was like, man, it's really hard to see him not getting $40 million in free agency at his rare young age and with his prospect, you know, pedigree. And so, yeah, I think something in the $40 to $60 million range is actually totally believable if he was on the open market. So to effectively buy him for 25, I mean, that's a win for the Braves in terms of kind of expected value. That said, if he doesn't pan out, then the Mariners win. I mean, to me, it's kind of that simple. And he can, I think Anthony was talking about this, he could pan out in a pretty low level way where he's like Jock Peterson light, and he could still be a valuable kind of platoon corner outfielder who manages to hit righties or something like that. And, you know, it wouldn't be hard for that to be worth $25 million in kind of the price of things these days. But, you know, if you look at what he's done so far, you could see betting against him. One trade that came to my mind that happened in 2015, it was similar to this in that it was essentially a young player being used as a mechanism to unload dead money. And the GMs were Dave Stewart and John Coppolella, Diamondbacks and Braves. And I think there's a tweet out there from Steve Adams that he never saw a trade so universally panned as it was, reflecting on what Dave Stewart did. And so, you know, Stewart basically traded Bronson Arroyo, who was injured at the time, to the Braves, but threw in Touki Toussaint, who was not, he was like, I think, a top 100 type of prospect at the time. And I think Arroyo was owed $10 million. And so the thinking was the expected value of Toussaint is definitely more than $10 million. Therefore, this trade is bad. But there was some percentage chance that Toussaint's actual value was close to zero. And that's kind of what happened. And so Stewart and Coppolella made a bet. And, you know, we might not have liked it at the time for Stewart, but he still won that bet. Maybe it's like he drew to an inside straight or something. Like, he took a bet. The odds aren't great, but he won. He won that bet. And so, you know, if Jared Kelnick busts, even if the Mariners do a crappy job replacing him and are bad in 2024 or something like that, if he busts and you got, you know, $25 million worth of relief for him, then you win. In terms of whether he will bust, I mean, I think it's a very interesting question. I think he seems to be in a better situation. You know, people are saying he'll bat ninth and he'll have that change of scenery, and he won't have to deal with the Mariners ballpark and stuff. And yeah, I mean, there's a good chance that the Braves figure something out with him and make him into a decent player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the initial reaction, I think most casual fans will overlook the money because most casual fans don't really care so much about what the team is paying. It's just like, you know, they want the team to be good, or, you know, they want their team to win trades. And so for a lot of people, it's like the Braves, what did they get? They got a left fielder. They got a back end starting pitcher. What did they give up? Like, you know.
Yeah, mostly money. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're like, oh, we gave away Jackson Kowar and some prospect I never heard of. Great. And so they ignored everything that you just said, which is that they are taking on $25 million to take a bet on Kelnick.
Well, I'm very much in the camp that fans shouldn't care about payroll stuff or what players cost, except when there's a clear opportunity cost of what they can't do because of it. So, you know, if the Orioles were to go out and quote unquote overpay for Yamamoto, fans should definitely not be like mad about if they were to pay him $325 million and 30 something million a year when everybody thought he would get less than that. Their payroll is so low that you can make an argument that doing so wouldn't really hinder them from other moves that they might be wanting to consider in the next few years. But the Braves, who have pushed their payroll, I think their luxury tax payroll, up into the $250 million range, for them to finish their offseason and kind of do what the other stuff they need to do, they have limited themselves in some ways. I think, you know, there's talk of they could trade Raisel Iglesias or Marcelo Ozuna to kind of clear some money. So it's like, okay, now we didn't just like give some money for Kelnick. We got Kelnick and a whole bunch of relievers, but then we subtracted a really good reliever, and then we added, you know, starting pitcher yet to be determined. And it's like this, it's kind of a big equation, and Kelnick is just one part of it. And so given where their payroll is and how far they've pushed it and how historically they haven't really pushed it at this level, you know, giving up money to get him absolutely affects other moves and other players. And so I think it was Steve Adams who's kind of saying, like, you know, if the White Sox did this, essentially bought Jared Kelnick and threw him into a corner outfield spot, that would be seen as nothing but a win. You know, like if it's a team that doesn't care if he's good, a team that has so much money, you know, to burn, then it makes tons of sense. But for the Braves, if he doesn't pan out, or if they have to trade away good players to accommodate him, then it might not make sense.
Yeah, and seeing the whole slate of moves is going to be important for the Mariners as well, right? Because they, so far, fans are probably disappointed with how things have gone because they didn't make a qualifying offer to Teoscar Hernandez. They gave away Eugenio Suarez in a salary dump deal. Now they're giving away Jared Kelnick in a salary dump deal. But if they do something interesting with that salary that they cleared up, then it'll have been worth it. But we'll have to, you know, reserve judgment.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of like making these evaluations of an offseason as a whole on opening day or near opening day, because, you know, it's December 5th today. I think the Mariners have been very clear that they're not done. It's possible that they fail to pull some things off. But, you know, you also have to look at the whole, you know, ownership situation and the decision to cut payroll. You know, they just raised ticket prices a lot. I mean, so to be mad about that, I think would be sensible. And to be mad about the trade because it is about cutting budget, that, you know, that's fair.
Okay, well, let's get to your questions here. This first one is from David, and another one from Big Bob. They're both about the Dodgers, so let's combine these. If the Dodgers miss on Ohtani, what's the next logical move for the front office? And then the question from Bob is, would the Dodgers be interested in Jung-Hoo Lee? What do you think about the Dodgers, Tim?
I think Yamamoto is kind of the number two or the 1B to Ohtani with the Dodgers. I think you can make a really good case that Yamamoto flat out makes more sense than the Dodgers, period. I mean, if you're thinking in the short term, 2024, it's a better fit to have the guy who's going to pitch. And even if you're thinking of 2025, like, what exactly is Ohtani going to give a team in his first year back, and how many innings is it going to be, and how effective are they going to be? We don't really know that. And I also think, too, you know, in terms of thinking about Ohtani's value in 2024, and this is just kind of a wild guess, but I just think that there's some chance that he starts the season on the IL. I think that that's not something that, you know, his agent wants to say, but I also think it's something that the teams can barely know right now, because I mean, I would assume he's given medical information to teams, but I think there's some chance that, you know, once he's all signed up and spring training is about to start, people say, hey, you know what? He needs to take April off because he's recovering from this elbow surgery. So, you know, as a 2024 move, Yamamoto could be better for the Dodgers. And I also think, you know, they have enough young players and prospects and stuff where trading for Glasnow or Cease would make a lot of sense. So if you were to add Yamamoto plus one of those really good trade candidates, you'd feel good. And I don't think you'd necessarily be lamenting not signing Ohtani. But they do need another outfielder. You know, we tried when we were making our top 50 free agent list to learn as much about Jung Ho Lee as we could. I think we talked to maybe like two people who seem to have like solid info on him. And he doesn't really have a lot of power. But he's also not said to have like kind of MLB quality center field defense. And so I'm like, okay, I mean, I might be missing something here, but if we're putting Lee in a corner and we're saying we're not sure he's going to hit more than like 10 home runs, then he's going to have to, you know, hit a whole lot of singles and doubles to be a valuable major league player. And I think that there's going to be teams that do not see it that way. Usually when there's kind of a player of unknown abilities with some intrigue, and if the agent is Scott Boras, it makes sense to kind of bet on him. I think with Yoshida last winter, that was a big example of kind of taking this somewhat unknown guy with some question marks and getting him $90 million. So I think Lee will get his money, and I don't know what the Dodgers' evaluations of him are, but just based on the couple people I talked to, I don't know that he's a great signing for what I think he will get.
Yeah, the Dodgers, I've said it on this podcast before, you know, they need pitching, and they have in the past seemingly preferred short-term contracts and avoided long-term contracts. But I feel like their need is strong enough that they will change that MO this winter.
Yeah, I think so. And I believe like they were pretty heavy on Aaron Nola, right? So, I mean, if they were willing to go up to 7 years there, that's definitely breaking their mold. And I think Yamamoto being 25, it's not hard to kind of justify a lot of years for him when you're only getting into his kind of age 33 or whatever it may be.
Okay, we got another question here from Ian, who says, contracts are getting completely out of hand. Now Ohtani might pull in $600 million this week. Will the runaway inflation of MLB contracts sink the sport soon? It seems like fans will take the brunt of the costs and eventually turn away. So, Tim, is baseball dead?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can understand that some people kind of just really don't like baseball players getting huge salaries. There's a certain portion of fans who just kind of have a visceral dislike of like players technically, quote unquote, playing a game, or even, you know, you also hear the playing a child's game line a lot. These guys work really hard, but I mean, the reason that they get the money they do is a supply and demand thing, in that, you know, there's less than 1,000 people on the planet who can do the things that Major League Baseball players do. And when you shrink it down to what Shohei Ohtani can do, there's literally one person on the planet. And so the teams pay these contracts because they think that the players are worth this money. So, I mean, I also think, you know, about the whole, you know, this is going to get passed on to fans thing. I would ask, you know, would lower player salaries result in reduced ticket prices for fans? I think we've not seen any evidence of that. I think if, you know, the Mariners could be an example. They just jacked up season ticket prices and then they're turning around to cut payroll. You know, shouldn't they in theory be dropping ticket prices? They're not doing that. I think they're pricing, all teams are trying to price their tickets based on demand. A couple teams I would pull out as an example would be the Cardinals. middle of the pack payroll, from what I could tell. Ticket prices are sixth highest in baseball. Orioles rank 10th highest on ticket prices, and they run a bottom three payroll in the entire sport. So, I mean, there's not this direct correlation where, hey, you know, if we spend less on players, we're going to get some discounts at the ballpark. It's kind of like if I'm building widgets and they cost me a dollar to make and the market will let me sell them for $100, I'm not going to sell them for $20 just to give everybody a deal. I've said this a lot, and this is definitely like a labor leaning opinion, but you know, I'm happy to debate it with the other side, I guess. If you're kind of rooting for backward movement in player salary while the game's revenue is growing, then I think that you're rooting for more money in the pockets of owners. I don't think that there's a third place that the money goes. It goes to the players and it goes to the owners, and they're fighting over this pie, and there's just kind of like an amount of money in the middle, a very large amount of money, billions, I guess, that every 5 years they haggle over. And you know, when the CBA talks come up, that's what that is. And so there's not like this thing where we're going to create the fan discount fund and take $1 billion each year and reduce ticket prices. That's not a thing that happens. So I think the players getting $40 and $50 million salaries, that's a lot more visible to fans than the owners kind of just like pocketing money. I mean, I think too, owning a baseball team has been like fairly economy proof, but you know, there's definitely forces that could, especially in the short term, that could result in some reduced salaries for players. You know, I think the whole Diamond Sports Group bankruptcy is a big one. So there's a Hannah Kaiser article I just read, and you know, she was kind of saying that MLB's long-term goal is to centralize the media revenue, distribute it equally, level the playing field a bit. And I know that some of the teams that own their own TV networks are going to not like that. That'll be owners arguing amongst each other over that. And so while that all shakes out, the teams that, you know, were getting a certain amount of TV money or were expecting a certain amount and then don't get that, they probably will cut their payrolls. You know, I think we're going to see that this offseason, and I think we're going to continue to see that. So if you like, you know, teams being cheap and that's your thing, there should be some of that coming.
Okay, we got one last question here from Steven, who wants to know, does anyone from MLB Trade Rumors attend the winter meetings? So a little behind the scenes info.
Yeah, here. That's a good one. The answer is sometimes, kind of, I guess when I feel like it, or when I feel like that we have a little bit of money to spare in terms of maybe flying two of us out there and having hotel rooms and meals and stuff, but also, you know, just a need to show our faces a little bit. And it seems like people are nicer if we show our faces every few years or something. I didn't go last year and I didn't go this year. Prior to that, two of them were canceled. So I think I'm going to go next year. Ben Nicholson Smith tipped me off that it is supposed to be in Dallas. I've never been there. So I think I'll be there in Dallas next year. And maybe, you know, somebody else from the MLBTR team will come out too. I think that when we take one of you guys and bring you out to the winter meetings, it makes the actual news coverage a little tougher. Doing the coverage from the media workroom is harder than doing it from your own setup at home. And it's also like, well, why would we fly you out there to put you in the media workroom and then just kind of monitor Twitter and write posts? So the question for the winter meetings to me has always been, you know, from an MLB Trade Rumors standpoint, is like the money that we spend to go out there is just money out of my pocket. And so, you know, how what's the ROI on that? And so it's one of those things that's intangible. Like it's nice to talk with, the baseball writers. It's nice to meet up with some agents and team people and kind of just chat a little bit. And like I said, show your face. But that doesn't directly result in like revenue for MLB Trade Rumors. So it's just one of those intangible things that I think we need to do periodically, but that I have stopped doing every year.
Okay, well, the winter meetings are going to be wrapping up this week, but at some point, whether it's at the winter meetings or otherwise, like I said earlier, the free agent hot stove is going to explode. Otani will sign somewhere, Yamamoto will sign somewhere, and then dominoes will start falling and it'll go nuts. So go to MLB Trade Rumors and we will be tracking all of that for you, and this podcast will be back next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.